Nationalist headlined how Palestine became Israel's spyware testbed. That does it for our show. Belated happy birthday to Ishmael Daro. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the U.S. House passes a funding bill to avert a government shutdown. Portland City Council considers gutting the Police Accountability Commission's proposal for a new police oversight system. And in international news, the opportunities and obstacles for a ceasefire in Gaza. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 14th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola. Late this afternoon, and just in time to avert a looming government shutdown on Friday, the U.S. House passed a measure to fund the government until early next year. CNN reports that President Biden has indicated he will sign the measure into law if it passes in the Senate. The funding measure was put forward by the new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, and was passed with a bipartisan vote of 336 to 95, with 209 of those votes coming from Democrats. The unusual two-step plan funds the federal government at current levels through January 19th for priorities such as military construction and veterans affairs. The rest of the government would be funded through February 2nd at current levels. The bill does not include additional aid for Israel or Ukraine or unnecessary cuts to government spending. The ongoing efforts to create a new police oversight system in Portland will continue tomorrow at a public hearing before City Council at 2 p.m. The city attorney will present the city's proposed code changes that would establish the new system. They will also take public comment. The city's proposal drastically scales back the proposal of the All-Volunteer Police Accountability Commission that was presented to council back in September. Cable reporters Jasmine Moneymaker and Sam Bowman have been following this process since 2021 and bring us this report.
In September, the Police Accountability Commission, or PAC, presented a detailed 96-page package of proposed city code language in front of a largely skeptical city council. The PAC was made up of 20 volunteers from the Portland community who spent most of the last 2 years in an intense process of creating a new police oversight system for Portland in accordance with ballot measure 26-217, which was passed by 82% of Portland voters in 2020. The ballot measure enshrined a new vision for police accountability in the city's charter. It mandates that the new system be independent of the police and political interference, that its budget be pegged to 5% of the police bureau budget, and that it have the power to subpoena and discipline officers who are the subject of misconduct complaints. Aside from those non-negotiables, the PAC spent the last 2 years ironing out the details of the procedures and makeup of this new body.
Now it's up to the city to propose amendments and changes to the PAC's proposed code language, which will be further bargained between the city and the U.S. Department of Justice and the city's police union before being approved in their final form by the city council next year. Last week, the Oregonian obtained a copy of the city's counterproposal, which cuts nearly 70 pages from the PAC's version, and also significantly weakens several aspects of the system the PAC created after their lengthy and intensive process of research, outreach, and discussion over the past 2 years. On Sunday, we spoke with Dan Handelman, longtime member of Portland Cop Watch and a former member of the Police Accountability Commission, which disbanded at the conclusion of its work on August 31st.
The other day, I was at a meeting where somebody described the city council's, or the city attorney's proposal, really, as being based on the PAC's proposal, but that's like saying that those shards of pottery on the floor are based on a vase. I mean, you know, it's just like they basically took everything we did, threw it down on the floor, broke it, and then picked up the little bits and pieces they liked, and then in order to try to glue it back together, they put in what they wanted, and it doesn't look anything like what was originally intended.
The overall oversight system created by the PAC has two main parts: an all-volunteer civilian board called the Community Board for Police Accountability, or CBPA, and a supporting city bureau called the Office of Community-Based Police Accountability, or OCPA, which answers to the civilian board. One of the fundamental pieces of the ballot measure and the language it enshrined in the city charter was a promise that no current or former law enforcement officers or their immediate families would be permitted on the new board. While the city's counterproposal keeps this prohibition in place, it does insert significant police involvement into the nominating process for board members. Here's former PAC member Dan Handelman again.
One of the criticisms we got back from several people in the city was you going into too much detail. Okay, so we said there'll be a nominating committee and we'll let them figure that out. And so instead, the city wrote in, this is what the nominating committee is going to look like, and they said one representative from the Portland Police Bureau and one representative from the Portland Police Association and one representative from the Portland Police Commanding Officers Association, which is outrageous, having three people with law enforcement picking members of a supposedly impartial, neutral review system. So reading further into their document, it says that when they're picking who the director is going to be, those same people are going to be sitting on that.
The city also added another requirement for members of the citizen board, in addition to the prohibitions on cops and their immediate families. The city language requires that board members do not have a, quote, demonstrated bias for or against law enforcement, end quote. The city does not clarify what exactly the parameters of bias for or against police would be.
I think we've struggled at Portland Cop Watch. We've struggled with this term for years. Like, we're saying we want the police to be held accountable, and people interpret that as being anti-police. That's not an appropriate interpretation. But if whoever's in charge of making that decision gets to say, well, you're part of a group called Portland Cop Watch, and you said that officer who killed that person should be held accountable for it, if that's anti-police, then we're not going to have any kind of a reasonable membership on this board. I mean, they also downplayed the necessity of people on this board having to have lived experiences in neighborhoods that are over-policed, and they are making people go on a ride-along. If you've been exposed to police misconduct, you're not going to want to be in a police car with an officer for any period of time in order to learn.
Again, that was Dan Handelman, former member of the Police Accountability Commission and an active member of Portland Cop Watch since the early 1990s. The city attorney and the PAC are far apart on the question of what cases the new oversight system will handle. In the PAC proposal, civilians would investigate nearly every category of alleged police misconduct. That approach is backed by the language of the ballot measure, which places no limits at all on the potential jurisdiction. But the city attorney has proposed a much more limited scope of work.
I really want to read you a part of the charter that this code is supposed to be based on. And I don't want to disparage the city attorney's office, but let me just say that it's pretty clear that they read something wrong. It says under Section 2-108, subsection C, the board may investigate other complaints or incidents of misconduct as they see fit or as mandated by city code. So in other words, they can investigate other complaints as they see fit, not that it has to be in city code. But the new code they propose says anything they add to that list has to be approved by city council. So that's in conflict with what the charter says.
Among the violations that the new oversight system would need to seek special counsel approval for are violations of the truthfulness directive. Untruthfulness is a fireable offense and would be handled by internal affairs instead of civilian investigators. Perhaps the biggest gap between what the PAC proposed and what the city attorney will present before council tomorrow is in the area of transparency and community involvement. Transparency in the police accountability process has been a constant community demand and one that the police and the city have continued to push back against. Police review board meetings are closed to the public, the reports on their findings are heavily redacted, and aside from appeals that come before the Citizen Review Committee, the public has no access to deliberations on police discipline at all. The PAC proposal allowed for the possibility that meetings would be open to the public whenever possible, and the community would be allowed to contribute comments for their consideration. The city attorney, on the other hand, has removed the word transparency from the definition of accountability altogether and stipulated that all case discussions will be held in closed executive sessions. The final votes would be held in a public setting, but the substance of the allegations would not be stated.
They did take the word transparency out from the beginning of the document and then pulled out a lot of items that would have made this entire process more transparent. Some of them are major, such as removing the option, which is legal under state law, for the board to decide that a hearing is in the public interest and they want to hold it in, in open session. But the officer gets to decide if they want to have an open session as well. But the language we put in about deciding if it's in the public interest is now gone. The word transparency actually does appear in their document at least once, because they're saying that the board members have to commit to upholding the city's core values of anti-racism, equity, transparency, communication, collaboration, and fiscal responsibility, which is very funny when you think about what the city has done to this plan, that they've gotten rid of the transparency, they've definitely ditched a lot of the anti-racism parts and equity parts that we built in.
Again, the changes will be presented by the city attorney at a public hearing tomorrow, November 15th at 2 p.m. Members of the public can comment either in person or virtually. Virtual testimony, though, needs to be registered by 1 p.m. tomorrow on the City Council website. People can also submit written testimony ahead of the hearing. There is also an email address where the city attorney will be accepting public comment for the next 30 days. But as Dan Handelman points out, the city attorney is not an elected official and is under no obligation to listen to the public or refer the city's proposal back to council after that 30-day period.
Certainly something they've said, that the people who voted for that in 2020 aren't the same people who are here now, and I don't think that's true. I mean, it's yes, the Black Lives Matter signs have gone away, and in fact, they took down the last murals of George Floyd from around the Pioneer Place Mall just this Friday, as a symbolic gesture, perhaps, as this is coming to a vote at City Council. But I think the people of Portland are still the same. And I think that even the people who have brought baseless allegations about what the PAC's intentions are said they believe in police accountability. And I think most people in the city believe in police accountability. And I think that what the city has done is made it so that it's going to be very hard to hold police accountable.
That was Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch and formerly of the Police Accountability Commission, who we spoke to on Sunday for this piece. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Jasmine.
In other local law enforcement news, Portland City Council voted to change a settlement agreement between itself and the U.S. Department of Justice. The changes were voted on at the November 8th City Council meeting. This means that the Department of Justice will no longer be in charge of overseeing Portland's compliance with the settlement. Instead, an independent monitor will be appointed as overseer. The settlement came about in 2014 after the Department of Justice found a pattern of Portland police using excessive force and violence against people experiencing mental health crises. The settlement was set to end in 2020, but Portland police violence during the Black Lives Matter protests changed their mind. Just last year, the Department of Justice found that Portland was out of compliance with 6 out of 7 sections of the agreement, including in their monitoring and penalizing of excessive force and in officer training. The changes made at council last week also mean the city could eventually monitor itself. Commenters at the meeting asked that local people be considered for the new monitor position. Portland police are currently implementing a body camera program that would help bring it up to speed with other major cities. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio, focusing on the connections between Oregon forests, social justice, and the climate crisis. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Your weather forecast tonight will be cloudy with a low of 40. Tomorrow, we'll see some rain showers and a high of 52. Looks like more sun is on the way for the end of the week. Today in history, in 1960, Ruby Bridges becomes the first black child to attend an all-white elementary school in Louisiana. White parents responded by protesting and pulling their kids out of school. Bridges was escorted by federal marshals every day that school year. The quote of the day is from Ruby Bridges, now 69 years old, who said, quote, "We may not all be equally guilty, but we are all equally responsible for building a decent and just society." One of the federal discrimination lawsuits against the Grand Gateway Hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, has now been settled. But it's not the last one to stem from the hotel owner's effort to ban Native people from their businesses. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Grand Gateway Hotel in Rapid City, South Dakota, has settled one federal suit, but still faces two more. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's C.J. Keene has more.
The settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the owning family of the Grand Gateway Hotel and Cheers Lounge in Rapid City comes over a year since the beginning of the saga.
The suit stems from owner Connie Urie's 2022 efforts to ban Native peoples from the business after an act of violence. This particular federal discrimination suit was brought by the DOJ after the incident, and the settlement terms must be approved by the federal court for the District of South Dakota. Under the agreement, Urie will be removed from any role from the business for the next 4 years. Additionally, the company will hire a compliance officer, train employees, and implement anti-discrimination policies while reaching out to South Dakota-based Native organizations. Those trainings are required for all owners, directors, partners, and employees of Retzel Corporation, the hotel's parent company, and will center around Title II protections which prohibit race-based discrimination in the hospitality industry. Further, an apology letter was published by the company's board, largely made up of Urie family members, acknowledging all Native peoples are welcome in their business. The letter will be sent to the presidents or chairpersons of each of South Dakota's tribal nations and to 19 news publications across the country. The company has 60 days to comply with the terms of the settlement. The two other ongoing lawsuits come from Indigenous Advocacy Network Indian Collective and a Wisconsin family, who both allege the hotel denied Native people service illegally. Both of those suits are pending. Representatives from the Retzel Corporation did not return request for comment.
For National Native News, I'm C.J. Keene in Rapid City.
Tribal leaders from across the country are gathered in New Orleans for the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention, where they're addressing top concerns. This week, they're hearing directly from government officials, including from the Interior Department, as Rhonda Lavaldo reports.
Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Brian Newland was at the convention in person to address attendees Monday and held a press conference in the morning. He was asked by reporters about the conclusion of the Interior Department's Indian Boarding School Road to Healing Tour. Newland and Secretary of the Interior Deb Holland hosted the year-long healing tour, traveling across the country, gathering testimony from survivors of Indian boarding schools and helping connect communities with trauma-informed support. The 12th and final stop was held recently in Montana. Newland was asked if the Interior Department would assist states in forming curriculum with accurate information and history of federal Indian boarding schools.
The President and Secretary Cardona at the Department of Education have been clear about, you know, curriculum standards and things like that. For us, what we want to make sure is just that we're doing an accurate truth-telling about what happened and being accountable for it and planning to move beyond that. And once that information is out there, and once we, the federal government, are accountable for it, it's not going anywhere. And so that will be accessible to everybody.
The Road to Healing is part of Secretary Holland's investigation into the troubled history of federal Indian boarding school policies and impacts on Native people. This week, NCAI's agenda includes a tribal consultation by the National Endowment for the Humanities on boarding schools and a National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition update. Other issues Newland was questioned about by reporters included cannabis, tribal colleges and universities, land as a trust, and the process for federal recognition status. I'm Rhonda Lovaldo for National Native News.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The sole Palestinian American voice in Congress, Democratic Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib, has been formally censured. But her colleagues, including Representative Cori Bush, say she will not stop fighting for peace in Gaza. Farah Siddiqui reports.
Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, the sole Palestinian-American voice in Congress, was officially reprimanded last Tuesday, but many of her colleagues say she will not stop fighting for peace. A 234-188 vote of nearly all Republicans and enough Democrats sealed Tlaib's censure, a punishment proposed by Republican Congressman Rich McCormick of Georgia. Tlaib held back tears as she asserted her position.
I can't believe I have to say this, but Palestinian people are not disposable. We are human beings, just like anyone else.
Tlaib is only the 26th member of the House of Representatives to be censured since 1789. She was not asked to stand in the well as typically expected with censure. Tlaib's House colleague Cori Bush from Missouri was by her side to defend her along with many other Democrats, all black and brown. Bush said the House is where an elected body enslaved black people because they thought it was right.
My colleagues are blatantly attempting to silence the only Palestinian American representative, but it's not surprising because this is the place where our black and brown staff members repeatedly speak of experiencing racism and sexism, Islamophobia, get pushed off of elevators, xenophobia, and more.
Bush added that Tlaib will be known for being a freedom fighter and a justice warrior. Bush called Tlaib a peacekeeper and said she's on the right side of history. For Michigan News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
November is National Family Caregivers Month, and caregivers often struggle to take care of themselves while performing their duties. Eric Tegedoff has more on the issue.
November is National Family Caregivers Month, and a few tips can help people with their duties. Head of the Oregon organization Aging Concerns, Vicki Schmall, says family caregivers often are called the backbone of long-term care. But she says people performing these roles must remember to think about themselves as well.
I often say to family caregivers, taking care of yourself is really the best gift you can give to the person who needs your care.
Schmall says it's critical that they be willing to ask for and accept help. She says there are local supports available for caregivers through programs such as Oregon Care Partners and the state's Aging and Disability Resource Connection. Schmall says people also should do their research early about potential facilities in the event in-home care becomes too much. She points to the service Elder Care Locator as a helpful resource in this search.
What is most important about decision-making is making decisions based on what is best, and not on promises I made earlier or feelings of guilt, and also not on pressures from others.
Schmall emphasizes that caregivers need to pay attention to how they're doing.
If as a caregiver you find yourself becoming socially isolated, it's a warning sign. It says the importance of making some change because social isolation is not good for either the family caregiver or the person receiving care.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The state of Oregon is sending $35 million in grant funding to support workforce training in high-demand industries. Those funds will support 30 projects across the state and more than 150 applicants. This is the largest round of funding awarded so far under the Future Ready Oregon Plan. This plan is a comprehensive $200 million investment package that supports education and training intended to help Oregonians get higher-paying jobs. The plan was approved by lawmakers in 2022, and the legislation sources the money from the state's general fund and federal pandemic relief aid. The plan focuses on historically underserved communities, including people of color, veterans, and those living in rural areas. The program targets the workforce training in three industries: healthcare, manufacturing, and technology. To be considered for a workforce-ready grant from the program, projects had to originate from community-based organizations like community colleges. The organizations ideally not only provide job training, but also help people dealing with things like housing and food insecurity. Seven community colleges were among those to receive project funding in this round. Other recipients include the Boys and Girls Club and tribal communities. Another round of grant funding is expected early next year. According to a new survey from the group Data for Progress, 66% of Americans say there should be a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. One commentator says attention needs to be drawn to the obstacles as well as opportunities that come with implementing a ceasefire, and that it's easier said than done. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Appeals for a ceasefire in Israel's war with Hamas are growing louder. Along with many governments and international and non-governmental organizations, the UN General Assembly, by a 120-14 vote, with 45 abstentions, has called for, quote, an immediate, durable, and sustained humanitarian truce leading to a cessation of hostilities. So far, that call has only yielded an Israeli decision on a daily four-hour humanitarian pause for North Gaza. I have seen very little detailed discussion of how a lengthy ceasefire might be achieved, so here are my thoughts on the complications of implementing a ceasefire, as well as the opportunities it might create. Those who want a ceasefire now are motivated by a desire to stop the killing, at least for the time agreed upon by the combatants. For a ceasefire to be effective, however, requires a number of agreements beyond initial acceptance. First, the warring parties need to agree on supervision of the ceasefire by a credible government or international organization such as the UN, so that lines of control are maintained, violations are reported, and communications between adversaries can be facilitated. Second, each side needs incentives to agree to a ceasefire, since each will not want to appear weak and will argue that a ceasefire mainly benefits the other side. Third, a ceasefire, unlike a pause, should make provision for discussion of ways to prevent the fighting from continuing. That might mean negotiations through a mediator of the hostage situation or extension of the ceasefire timeline. Fourth, adversaries have to agree to steps to protect civilian populations, unhindered aid deliveries, for instance, and freedom of movement out of the war zone. These conditions look very hard to meet in present circumstances. Israel is determined to decapitate the Hamas leadership so that the October 7 atrocities never happen again. A ceasefire would bring its military campaign to a halt, just as it is entering a new phase of rooting out Hamas fighters and destroying its infrastructure. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is tying a ceasefire to release of all the hostages, which might be considered a non-starter, but could be viewed by Hamas as an incentive to bargain. Various sources report that negotiations on a limited ceasefire and hostage release have taken place. Giving up hostages might appeal to Hamas if it gets something tangible in return beyond the opportunity to recuperate, such as Israel's release of some 4,500 Palestinians in its prisons. On the other hand, Hamas might see a ceasefire as enabling Israel to rehabilitate its international image, which has been badly hurt by its bombing campaign. Better for Hamas to maintain what it may see as the high ground in international support for its resistance to Israel. The head of Hamas, interviewed in Lebanon, promised that October 7 was, quote, just the first time, and there will be a second, a third, a fourth. He evidently thinks atrocities against Israelis are popular in the Arab world. Technical conditions for an effective ceasefire may ultimately stand in the way of being adopted. Can both Israel and Hamas agree on how the ceasefire will be supervised and by whom? Can they agree on how violations will be handled? Can they even agree on how long the ceasefire should last? Are the different components of the Israeli government and Hamas likely to agree on the terms of a ceasefire? In short, a ceasefire is far easier to call for than to implement. Above all, it takes a change of mindset in the warring parties' leaderships and the sustained cooperation of outside parties. both sides need finally to conclude either that the benefits of a ceasefire outweigh the benefits of war, or that the costs of war outweigh the costs of a ceasefire. For example, the Israeli government might give priority to getting the hostages back in response to pressure from the families. That would be both a benefit and a reduction of costs. For Hamas, giving up the hostages might relieve it of an asset that has declining value compared with continued battlefield losses. Such an agreement, or even a gesture in that direction, might jumpstart negotiations for a lengthy ceasefire that stops attacks on civilians. Agreement on a ceasefire has one often overlooked downside: failure. Should many violations occur that lead one or both sides to lose trust in the process, the war is likely to resume with even greater intensity than before. Beyond that, there will be little hope of seeking a ceasefire again, or even a pause, or for that matter, an agreement of any kind. So those who arrange a ceasefire need to get it right the first time. Otherwise, talk about a peace settlement or Gaza's governance future is not just premature, it is hopeless. I'm Mel Gertal for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 14th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, Chris Gow, Josh Salem, Sam Bowman, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Michelle Coppola. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Farah Siddiqui, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, please go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.